your face, peep my words, words. Heavenly words, words. Now your niggas locked up in the 73rd. Peep my words, words. Heavenly words, words. Now your niggas locked up, locked up, locked up. Yeah. And yo, I'm.
If it sounds like Montreal, it sounds like CKUT. CKUT's annual funding drive is back, and this year we're celebrating the city that made us. From Friday, March 15th to Sunday, March 24th, tune in for an earful of Montreal-made magic. Your favorite programmers will be live in studio and live streaming online for the first time ever. Tune in online, on the good old-fashioned radio, or join us in person. CKUT friends and family will be providing the tunes for an opening party at Bar La Marche à Côté on March 14th and a closing night on March 23rd at Nouvel Etablissement. Stay tuned at our website for other events that put the fun in fundraising. Don't miss these celebrations of community radio and sounds of the city from your favorite local DJs. We need $50,000 to keep CKUT on the map. Powering a nonprofit radio station is more expensive than ever. Will you answer the call of your community before it's too late? Donate now by visiting ckut.ca/donate or by calling 514-907-9424. CKUT 90.3 FM, the sound of Montreal since 1987.
Hello, and welcome to Gay and Grey Live. My name is Daniel Wiley, and along with David Cassidy, we are going to talk about Alzheimer's and dementia this week, and how this affects the 2S LGBTQIA+ community. Later in the program, we're going to hear David and Greg's story, as we interview Greg as he speaks about David, his partner for over 24 years, who has been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. But first, I would like to start by exploring the differences between dementia, Alzheimer's, and senior's moments. Aging is something that all creatures in nature experience. As we grow older, we experience gradual changes to our brains and our bodies. Some of these changes may affect us either physically or mentally, and may increase our risk of disease. The majority of individuals are unlikely to encounter memory issues. As we grow older, most of us can expect our memory to remain robust, with no significant or rapid decline. In our later years, we will retain the skills and knowledge acquired throughout our lives. A portion of the population may undergo memory challenges. Once we reach the age of 65, nearly 40% of individuals may encounter varying degrees of memory loss. However, even in cases of memory loss, the probability of developing dementia is relatively low. In general, the extent of our memory challenges is often mild, allowing us to continue our daily lives without significant disruption. A smaller percentage of us will develop dementia. The WHO estimates that after we turn 60 years old, 5 to 8% of us will live with dementia at some point. With dementia symptoms, including memory loss, gradually worsening to the point where our abilities seriously deteriorate and we are no longer able to take care of ourselves. Why is there such a difference in the percentage of people experiencing memory loss and the percentage of people living with dementia? To put it simply, there are different levels of memory loss, and not all memory loss is due to dementia. So how can you tell which is which? There are various degrees of memory loss. One of these is called age-associated memory impairment. If you are facing memory difficulties, but they are not significantly disrupting your daily activities, not impeding your usual task completion, not hindering your ability to learn and remember new information, and no underlying medical condition is causing these memory losses, then you likely have what is referred to as age-associated memory impairment, or as you hear commonly used, a senior moment. Age-associated memory impairment is regarded as a typical aspect of the aging process and should not be interpreted as a sign of dementia. Between age-associated memory impairment and dementia lies a condition termed mild cognitive impairment, MCI. As implied by its name, MCI presents mild symptoms, including memory loss, as well as other issues like difficulty speaking and disorientation. However, these symptoms are not severe enough to disrupt your regular daily functions and routines. Nonetheless, individuals with MCI face an elevated risk of developing Alzheimer's disease or another form of dementia compared to those with age-associated memory impairment. When your memory loss reaches a severity where it disrupts your daily life and hampers your usual routine, or poses challenges in learning new information, complicate the completion of familiar tasks, and become noticeable to others in your close circle, reflecting changes in your abilities. At this point, your memory challenges align with what is commonly observed in the initial stages of dementia. Nevertheless, to know for sure whether you have dementia is to consult with your doctor and undergo the appropriate testing. Dementia is a term encompassing a range of symptoms linked to a decline in memory, reasoning, or other cognitive abilities. Various types of dementia exist, arising from different conditions. Mixed dementia refers to a situation where the brain undergoes changes characteristic of more than one type of dementia simultaneously. Alzheimer's disease is the predominant contributor to dementia, responsible for 60 to 80% of cases. Alzheimer's is a progressive brain disorder resulting from intricate changes in the brain due to cell damage. This leads to a gradual deterioration of cognitive functions, culminating in dementia symptoms. Difficulty recalling new information is often the initial sign. As the disease primarily affects the part of the brain associated with learning. As Alzheimer's progresses, symptoms intensify, encompassing disorientation, confusion, and behavioral alterations. Ultimately, challenges with speaking, swallowing, and walking emerge as the disease advances. Older 2S-LGBTQIA+ persons are not immune to dementia or Alzheimer's. They may have a more difficult time managing these diseases as many queer people are alone or do not have family to help them through. We will hear David and Greg's story, a loving story which illustrates some of the care that a person with Alzheimer's will need. Please note that the information shared on this program should not be used as a diagnostic tool and is not a substitute for informed medical advice. If you are concerned that you or someone you know has dementia, please talk to your doctor. You can contact your Fédération Québécoise of Alzheimer's Societies at https://alzheimer.ca, Fédération Québécoise /EN, or at 514-369-7891. You can also email them at info@alzheimerquebec.ca, and their address is at 460 Rue St. Catherine West, Bureau 507, in Montreal, Quebec, H3B1A7. If you live outside of Montreal in Quebec, you can find your local office at the website identified above. If you live in another province or country, search for your local Alzheimer's Society. And now I would like to introduce David Cassidy as he interviews Greg.
Today we're very honored to have Greg Blanchard with us, and we're talking about a scenario or a situation where a lot of us, as we get older, are beginning to fall into and not sure how to cope and deal with it. And here we have hopefully an example of how a couple that are going through, one who has Alzheimer's, going through ways of existing and limiting and how they can keep functioning and have as much of a life as they can. So I'd like to turn it over to Greg to give us some sort of background and tell us about you and David and how you got together.
Sure. Okay. Thank you. And thank you very much for welcoming me to this program, Gay and Grey program. Myself, a bit about myself. As you said, my name is Greg Blatchford, and I'm a 74-year-old cisgender gay man, white gay man, and my pronouns are he and him. And I grew up in suburban Toronto in the 50s and 60s, and I came out, so I've been a lifelong homo. I came out when I was 21 in downtown Toronto. That's a whole other story. But after having lived in Sydney, Australia, lucky to have that, London and Germany in the 70s and 80s, I arrived in Montreal in 1991. So I've been here longer than I've lived anywhere else here. I love living in Montreal. And why did I move here? Well, I think it's a common story for many of us, is that I fell in love with Jean-Pierre, and he invited me to live with him here in Montreal. We were together for 5 years, but we split up after that, but I still stayed because I loved being here. I was involved in Gayline and some of the early activist movements that were around at that time. I have had a pretty good, well, what should I say, active activist life. But what happened was I stayed in Montreal, and then a few years later, we're up to 1999 now, I was a regular visitor to the YMCA to work out in their downtown gym on Stanley Street. And I did aerobics classes with the gay boys. We were up in the front row kicking and dancing, and I noticed this cute guy at the back at the YMCA in the aerobics class. And I thought, he's cute, you know. And so, as we do at the YMCA, we're looking around. But he wasn't keeping very well in touch with the music, you know. He wasn't keeping the beat. So I thought, oh, he can't be gay. I guess he's not gay because he can't. That's a terrible stereotype. Yeah, I know. But then, of course, as one does afterwards in the sauna and showers where we go after the classes, I started chatting with him at different times over weeks. This wasn't just once and then something started. We would meet, say hi, chit-chat. I'm chit-chatting to everybody. He did tell me later I was one of the biggest talkers in the sauna. Anyway, so it was fine. And then it actually took a few months. And because I worked at McGill, I had a McGill staff director, and he had told me he worked at the Montreal Children's Hospital. So I stalked him. I found his name in the McGill staff directory, and I phoned him up just because I want to see where this might go. I did know by this time he was gay, so we had talked about that. And what happened was he picked up. I mean, I didn't have a record, you know, he was working in his office and he picked up. And so we had a nice chat, and I said, should we go for coffee? And he said, okay.
So how many years have you been together?
That was 1999. And we went to coffee that got elevated to a dinner. And then we went a weekend away in Charlevoix area, and that just started it. So that was 2000 by then. So we've been 24 years, and we got married in 2010. So it's the longest relationship. Well, of course, it's the longest relationship I've ever had. Very happy. And funny coincidence, David's from Toronto too. So we both were originally from Toronto, but we met here in Montreal. He came for work, not love. I came for love and got work. So that's the difference between us. So that's kind of the background and we're both the same age, virtually the same age, 74. He's just a few months older than me.
That's cool. My partner and I are both the same age too. So funny how that sometimes works out. So when did David start to develop Alzheimer's?
Well, I would say around 2016, 2017. So that's about 7 years ago. I started noticing like strange things that we'd just be talking at the kitchen table or, you know, having dinner. And I'd say, well, you know, yesterday when we met up with so-and-so and we went out, and what was that? I said, you remember when we met? And he actually didn't remember.
Exactly.
So I thought, well, he's just, that's odd, but didn't think much about it. And then, but it was beginning to happen more and more, where even something that happened just a few hours earlier, it wasn't sticking. And also anything I said to help him recall it, I mean, that's the sign, is that it never got implanted. So I began to think, what is going on? I said to him, what do you think is, because that seems funny. And he'd say, well, it's a senior's moment. You know, I just can't quite remember. But I know my senior's moments are when I may not remember things as quickly as I used to, but it does eventually come back, especially if there's triggers.
Did David feel frightened about what was going on?
Interestingly, at first, he just didn't really want to think about it.
Yes.
Yeah. He didn't really want to think about it, and I was thinking a lot about it, but I must say that he did say that he would go to see his GP. So he went to see his GP, and I'm not sure, I wasn't there, but I don't know what happened, but within, and this is great with his GP, he had a referral instantly almost to a neurologist at the Douglas Hospital in the McGill Center for Studies in Aging, which is a wonderful organization, which I've subsequently learned. So we went and had an interview with Dr. Gauthier there at the Douglas, maybe. He's Serge. A famous name, yeah. Serge, yes. And he gave him the MoCA test. That's the Montreal Cognition Assessment Test, I think it's called. And he did pretty well. But he said, but there was a few hiccups. And he said, you probably have MCI, moderate cognition. MCI, oh, I'm forgetting it. But it's like, it's not Alzheimer's. It's just, I'm sorry, I want it, because this is it's kind of an interesting thing, that moderate cognitive impairment. There we go. It took a while, you see.
Yeah.
But and so what he did then is set David on a whole series of tests. Blood test, lumbar puncture, MCI, not MCI, MRI, getting my M's at the MNI, so get those combinations of letters to get. Yeah, I know. And so what happens was, we went back for an appointment. We're at 2018 now. And he said, yes, it's Alzheimer's, because there was a scan of the brain that showed this amyloid material that was going around. And what he said was that, given though David was still doing well-ish on the assessment tests, that, and there's a term for it, which again I'm not going to remember, where because his job and his life was so cognitively stimulating, he was a pediatrician at the Montreal Children's Hospital, that might have explained why the level of amyloid in his brain would normally indicate less capable. He was more capable than you might expect. Anyway, there isn't always necessarily a correlation between the muck in your brain that's stopping these transmissions and your actual ability. So, and I'll just finish by saying that he didn't really want to talk about it particularly. He just wanted to say, I'm going to live day by day in his life, and I'm just going to take things out. Part of me, as a partner who knew what our future was, wanted to talk about it. You know, but I quickly learned that's not my place particularly.
I have two questions. One, some of the new medications that have been developed, he's on some of the new stuff. And two, how is this affecting you? Everybody talks about the patient and how they're thinking, but the caregiver also has concerns and difficulties, and as you pointed out, you can't always express those to your partner because he doesn't understand. So where do you go to get some support for you?
Well, let's start with the meds. Donepezil is what is an old med, and he's been on that right from the beginning. And I do think it slowed down the progression, but after a while, it doesn't. I think David's progression was slow, comparatively speaking.
Good.
For both maybe his cognitive kind of strength, but also the medication. The new tests, because David, and this is kind of an interesting story, the doctors wanted both of us to be involved in the research projects they were doing on the new drugs.
Good.
So, and I was a control subject, and David was a person living with Alzheimer's. And we went through years of, well, what do I mean years? We have a series of PET scans, MRIs, cognitive tests, which I hated. But, you know, they would test your skills.
Yes.
3 hours worth of questions. But, and then he would do it. And we did a lot of those series. And then he couldn't cope with it anymore. He didn't do it. All I'm saying is that what they also learned, because they do lumbar punctures, and I don't want to pretend I understand it, but what they realized that David's gene combination was not one that would be able to be helped by the new drug. So the new drug that I think what you're referring to, its name I've forgotten, only works if there's certain combinations in the brain. So he did not get it, and he has not had any other drug.
It's not a panacea.
It's not a panacea. And I think we're jumping, I mean, Alzheimer's research has gone on for decades and decades, and we're jumping at things, but I don't, I mean, to me, if there is anything that's going to come up, it's too late for us.
So. Well, the trouble with our age group, so to speak, is that it's more and more likely for us to be exposed because people around our network, not necessarily our partners, but our network, people are falling victim to this disease because at our age it's more common to have to for it to be expressed, and a lot of us don't know how to respond to that, which is why this program could be very helpful for people to they may be falling into it and not sure how to proceed, and hearing how you're coping helps them to cope too.
Well, I can tell you a bit about that story.
Okay.
Which you asked about, like my own care and care for David. David didn't want to do any Alzheimer's-related activities at the beginning. But once I had the diagnosis, and by the next season, the 2018, I started at the Alzheimer's Society for Greater Montreal, which is headquarters on Notre Dame in Saint-Henri, that have an 8-week introductory course for caregivers like myself. I signed up, got on it as soon as I found about it, and I got a place. And so for 3 hours once a week for 8 weeks, we went in and learned the basics about the disease, the medical side, the impact on David, you know, your person you're living with, and the impact on yourself. So they were right from the beginning saying the only way, the best way for you to look after David is to look after yourself.
Excellent.
And so that was the message that's been in my head from the beginning. It's sometimes easier said than done.
Yes, always easier said than done.
So that's a bit of the issue, but it is a very important to keep that in your head. So, and what happened?
I can't stress how important that is, because people tend to focus on the patient, and the caregiver is so important to and for the patient, and it's usually somebody that's forgotten about, and how to support them in their giving support is a major basic question, which is why I'm trying to concentrate on that here, because it's such a useful piece of information.
Okay, well, I agree with you. I do think, though, that people are more, and I'll give you my example of our social worker, but I'm just in the social services, but they are more aware of the importance of keeping us going, because the more they keep us going, the more they don't, well, to put it bluntly, they don't have to look after the patient as much in the CHSLDs or in the nursing homes. So what happened, then it turned into this group, was a support group, and I've been in that support group ever since. So we meet every 2 weeks on Zoom, we did, talking about how our partners are going. And it's a wonderful place because we get to have jokes, we can make fun of what's happened, or we can have cry, or we can have serious discussions about what's out there. And I've learned so much by being in a support group where other people have, well, they've gone to this agency, they what went well here, what went well there. And for 2 years I was in it and didn't really do much else. It was the pandemic as well, but it took me to 2022 to ask the neurologist, which was now Dr. Gauthier had retired, and it was Dr. Peso Neto. Oh, I'm forgetting his name. Anyway, he's great. He's wonderful. And I get a referral to the social services, and within 2 months, I had a social worker in our house assessing us.
How do you feel, as an example, you're in a couple, but somebody might not be in a couple and be facing this by themselves without much of a network? What would be some of your suggestions for them to, one, accept their situation, and two, to one of the, if I can just program, one of the things we're doing is developing a visitor kind of program to give a person that's in your situation some support and allow them to leave somebody can be there for a bit while you go on and have something for yourself, or go shopping, or just go coffee, or go outside and scream, whichever you feel comfortable with. But it's, we found that it's important to help support people in isolated situations and to help them cope and to give them some support. It doesn't have to be a social worker coming in, just a person trying to develop a relationship with your partner and something to make him feel comfortable while allowing you an opportunity to be you.
I completely understand the dilemma that people who don't have, because I'm David's voice in a way, so I can advocate for him. And if he was on his own, for one thing, I don't think he would feel he wanted to bother people. But secondly, he wouldn't know where to go. And I'm good at, I think I'm incredibly privileged is another way, because I kind of know social workers, I know the system, I know who I can talk to, I've learned through my support group. And if you're isolated, you're going to have a harder time understanding what's available and how to access it. Because there are things available, it's not always easy, even with a spokesperson like myself, to get the service. And definitely having respite care is what the social worker could provide. So, and I think you need a referral from a neurologist or a doctor to go to social services, and hopefully they will get it. Because, but if you're on your own, you will need someone to organize the coming and going of other people to come into the house and manage it. And that's not easy, but that's what social workers have to do.
You can ask for a social worker. You don't necessarily have to be referred.
Oh, okay. I did ask once and didn't get very far, but well, because, things went fast. Anyway, go, yeah, tell us.
Yeah. Well, it's important that you have, David's lucky to have you as a voice, but if you don't have a voice, they tend to, social workers, depending on that, because the ridiculous pressures that all the different professionals are under trying to cope, they're going to try to take some of the easier routes to deal with themselves in the process, but eventually they have to deal with the who's being referred and what their needs are, and eventually it works its way down the system. So it's important to try, if you don't have a partner, to refer yourself into the system, and you can do that.
If you feel okay about acknowledging you have a problem, because that might be another.
That was a given, but you're quite right. And a lot of people will have difficulty accepting their situation, which is why having a support system, your own network, however defined, is really vital. And to one of the basic things that we all can do is make sure that we develop our own little network and to try to do things, whether it's cooking together, whatever you feel that's useful in your life to create and sustain a network.
I think that's so true. And that's why the group like Gay and Grey is so important, because I imagine people will notice each other if there's something and say, do you want to do this or can I do this for you? And that's wonderful to be with others, because you must imagine, like, how do social services find people who are isolated? And that's a sad story too, especially if they deteriorate. Then it probably relies on neighbors to say something, maybe, or
postman. I mean, it comes from all kinds of different sources. The bank people. Bank people are extremely useful, and because they see things. When I was a social worker, the bank people always called us about different people with different problems and saying, you need to intervene here because they could be abused, or they don't understand how to operate a machine, or simple little things that will give somebody a clue, and they pick it up. And developing a relationship with the CLSC is really important.
That is so nice to hear that banks would know, because they do see, you know, people fumbling or whatever, or giving money away or something. So that's wonderful that they signal to you. And just to say that since 2022-23, with the social worker who happened to get on, I mean, the other thing I can say to people is be as gentle and kind to the people who are trying to help you. I mean, because they've got a tough job, right? And if you can helpfully make it more pleasant for them, that's one I find that's worked. Like, complaining is not going to get you too far. Just try to understand the situation and tell you, because it's a delicate balance. You don't want to completely not be pushy a bit, but you have to be, what do I call it, nicely pushy or politely pushy and reminding people. And some people say, oh, they haven't called me back. Well, after a few weeks, you call them back. Don't keep waiting all the time.
Squeaky wheel gets the oil.
Oh boy, that's interesting that you say that from your background too. And it does help. But people are self-conscious maybe,
yes.
and that's hard. So we have now with the Alzheimer's Society of Greater Montreal, I go on their Art Links program with David. That's where we go to the Musée des Beaux-Arts. They have a wonderful once a month, and we look at a few paintings and then we do art ourselves. So it's kind of craft and we do it together. We also have chair yoga we do at home. It's full of wonderful services once you're tapped in. David goes to his activity day once a week. They have a full day of activities. And we have transport adapté to permission. So a taxi comes and picks him up, takes him there, and brings him home. So because it's a bit far from where I live in the plateau, it adds another hour to my respite, not having to pick him up or drop him off. So that's another service that's available. With the local social services, the social worker has been able to get David a day at another activity center, which is in a centre du jour in a CHSLD.
Right.
Now, what is interesting, it's mostly Francophone. And they had what they called an allophone group, where you had Portuguese, Chinese, Spanish speakers. But I noticed when I went and visited a few times, they all spoke French very well. But what I watched David, and it's kind of irrelevant, I'm sad or whatever to say, the language they're using, because and I've also learned myself, it's not words, it's tone.
Yes.
And they're so wonderful there that they know, and of course some speak English, and if it's necessary, they'll say something in English, no problem. But it's a Francophone environment, and David gave lectures in French. But that has, I mean, he was very good, but it's just dropped.
Yes.
And to very quickly, because it's second language acquisition, though that kind of goes faster.
As you go backwards, yeah. As you into the disease longer, you go the back, more backwards you go, and you forget what's there, but you go back into early life. So things that, if you didn't learn a language back then, you won't remember that.
I know. But what is interesting to me is that it's irrelevant. That it's a Francophone group, and he's fine, he comes home. By the way, when he comes home, how was it? It's kind of like, what?
Yeah.
He is already on the taxi drive. I don't ask him, what did you do? Because he has no memory.
So how do you respond to
that? I say, did you have a good day? I mean, and he said, oh, people were nice.
Well, never mind him so much, how about you?
I just am used to that's what it is. Like, nothing sticks. Nothing sticks.
How does it affect you then?
Well, I'm used to it. I've got lots of feelings about what's going on, but that's not a particular kind of sadness. I don't know why I say that, because, like, we'll go for dinner. Now, this is a wonderful... I have to say, I'm lucky with David, because his temperament has not changed. One iota. And
the basic person was a good person. Yeah.
And, you know, that makes me cry, you know, because... You know the stories of people with Alzheimer's they get anger, they change their personalities, irregular, irrational behavior. None of that with David. And what a blessing.
Yeah.
I mean, so in a way, when you say, I feel I'm so lucky in a way, having on, well, it's not lucky, it's a shitty journey, but given how worse it could be, this is such a blessing. So we go out, and that means, I'll tell you, David, that we can go out to dinner with four friends or maybe up to six. He will sit there the entire evening without saying anything. But his nonverbal body language is perfect. I mean, he looks at people who are talking. If we're all smiling, he smiles. So he's kind of mimicking, because it's about tone and mood and feeling.
Yes.
And, you know, we go afterwards, I ask him pretty quickly, so how was that? And you know what he says each time? Oh, everyone was very nice. So, I mean, that's what he leaves with. And by the time we get home, he's forgotten. That's just it. That's just what it is. And I am so lucky. Now, I will say that, although I've said these positive things, what's happened recently is he's starting occasionally, when we're outside or in a busy, crowded place with noise, he will have what I'm calling either an anxiety attack or a panic attack.
Yeah.
So this is where he wants to go home. And if we're near home, we go home. He lies down, falls immediately asleep. 30 minutes later, gets up. I say, oh, how do you feel now? Oh, fine. It's completely gone. But I do worry when we're further away. And now I don't go to any places that are busy. Or see, that's why I'm saying dinner, we're sitting down in a quiet environment, four people, fine. But you stand up, you're walking with noise, it's different.
Yeah.
So all of us have to learn as caregivers the unique situations, because the path Alzheimer's takes is very different for different people.
Well, that's also true. But the point you're making about the air, the where you are, too much stimulation can be overwhelming. And that's why they tend to withdraw. That's a defensive mechanism. I understand that. But it's good to have smaller groupings where they can try to concentrate or try to feel that they're fitting in and feel comfortable in that. And yet, you're totally right. The atmosphere, the tone, the comfort level is so important as to how they respond and to how they get support. Because if it's too difficult, then they're just going to withdraw more. So that's not so good.
No, that's true. And I'm very lucky. And what I have learned in my support groups connected with this is about the concept of ambiguous loss. This is a concept I've understood as a kind of, when you lose someone who dies, of course you experience grief, but you also know the person is gone. You see them buried, you see them cremated, whereas the person you're seeing is gone in a way, but they're still physically there. And to me, I've lost the person I can have long conversations with. I haven't lost the person I remember. I have to say this sad story in my support group. There's one, a woman who talked about her husband who's living with Alzheimer's, and she said, it's like living with a stranger. I mean, and to me, Dave, it's not a stranger. So I feel that's the difference sometimes, is that if they change so much. So my ambiguous loss and my grieving is tempered by the fact I still see part of the person there. But I think it's like, you know, the four stages of grief, or four or five. I think I've kind of got to acceptance.
Good,
you know,
good.
Gone through anger, sadness, you know, the different steps. And acceptance, I mean, I go in and out of it, but I just feel, I mean, it's been 7 years. So you're like, you kind of come to deal with this is it. And especially now I've got social services involved. I have that bathing respite care where someone comes in and gets paid through the Chèque Emploi service system. So you've got to learn the systems.
Exactly.
And you've got to know, and you've got to manage. See, the person we've got, Emile, wonderful guy from Rwanda originally. He's been here for a year, but he's got another job because we don't have enough work for him to do full time. So sometimes his schedule doesn't match when we need him. And sometimes when he says, I'm available, and we don't need it because he's at a respite day or whatever. So that's you're managing the care.
You have, I believe, a website. Perhaps you could tell us, people who didn't know you or you and David well enough can consult the website and see some of the things that you both have done and how you're coping and how follow up from today's interview.
Thank you. The website is gregblatchford.com, GREGGBLACHFORD.com. I will tell you though, David, is that it's a history of my kind of gay activism and gay life. It's my memoirs with snapshots. I call it Gay Man's Story in Snapshots. I've only got up to 1982. So what you said, my David story is not there. In fact, this is the first time I've kind of gone public with David's story.
Well, thank you for that.
It's sort of kind of been feeling semi-private. And so I'm happy to tell my story because I'm feeling, you know, more accepting. And I want, hopefully, to share some information. The website is more about my life. I haven't got to David yet, but I do plan to write. So it's an ongoing process, a project that I love doing. It's kind of a difference from, it's a break. It's my own respite, to be honest.
Exactly. You are a gay couple dealing with a disease that's common throughout the population, but how it affects our community and how we cope is somewhat unique. So perhaps you can give us some insights some suggestions as to how we as a community respond to this.
I want to start by saying that fortunately, I have not experienced any pushback in any of the services that I've been talking about by the fact we're a gay couple. When we turn up some places, they wonder if we're brothers. I'd say, no, we're conjoint, you know, we're married. I mean, David was a bit more closety than I was through his life. But I kind of approach the social services, the support system, as I've always approached heterosexual majority organizations or other people, that is thinking, well, I'm sure they'll find it interesting that we're a gay couple, you know, that it's different. And I honestly think I approach it that there won't be a problem. I approach it that it's normal. I'm going to talk about myself with that. And I also don't necessarily feel I have to always say, well, you know, we're gay. No, I just might say, well, I'm lucky because I've got a partner. So that's an easy way to come out without having to say you're gay, because here's my same-sex partner. So I understand for people who are single, you may have to make the announcement. I know there have been horrific stories about some pushback in some agencies, but I'm kind of thinking, well, that's different. You know, so they'll approach it as someone did something different, and they'll see my confidence, and they'll see we're, you know, looking after each other, and they'll be fine. That's just been my experience. Now, that's not the same as having to live in a CHSLD where you don't have a partner, where you don't have an advocate, you maybe don't have friends come in, and you're more isolated. So again, the kind of theme we've been talking about, the more support you have from friends or family to manage anything that might happen in these institutions is very important.
Do you think the community should develop complementary services like the Alzheimer's Society, but within the gay community, or something more specific like that? Would that be helpful?
I think it's too big a project. I mean, an informal support group for caregivers like I've got, but all gay lesbian, because I haven't met other... There was one lesbian who turned up in my support group, the one I've been in for all these years. And I thought, wait a minute, I thought I was the only gay in this group. What are you doing? No, I'm kidding. But we kind of joked and we had a good time. But she left after three sessions. I mean, it's not for everybody, this support group. No. I think she had her own kind of support system. So, but to be honest, yeah, it would be nice. And I don't know, to be honest, if Montreal Anglo Group or... I don't even think Azure has an Alzheimer's dementia support group.
I'm not aware of one.
So I think informally, but to set up a whole system, I don't know. But I think it's nice that it's being recognized. It's nice that that hopefully we're still able to use the agencies that are out there without having to create. I mean, in some ways, it's better to make sure they're doing a good job. And you know, Bill Ryan, and yes, who went around social services in the 2000s trying to educate social workers and people in social services about lesbian gay lives. And they hit, you know, some pushback. But generally, I think it's a more accepting environment. And if you do have any trouble, well, I would think reporting them is you would do.
Well, that's one
if you thing. Can. But you need confidence to do that. And it's not always easy. I don't want to make it sound easy.
No, but a group that does advocacy can always intervene there. But that's the benefit of having a social worker, because they can also refer you to these, because they have just a wealth of resources. That's how they exist. Developing resources, they don't have them. Any words of wisdom that you want to add dealing with specifically the gay community and questions around sexual orientation and so on that relate to this? It's sort of a subject, but not dealt with or ignored.
I think that the important message I might want to get across to people is that it's the knowledge that support is out there, but it does need persistence and determination to access it sometimes. So you have to be patient and you have to follow up. You have to, I think, smile and be kind to those who are trying to help you. There's lots of goodwill out there, but you need to be persistent at the same time. Having a GP and or a gerontologist and or a neurologist is very helpful, but I am completely aware that that's difficult sometimes to get access to those. But the GP is your key to getting some more specialist help. Or the GP, some GPs can be perfectly adequate on their own on accessing services. There is a huge amount of information available too. And at first I went to all the workshops, I read all the books as much as I could, but it became, to be honest, overwhelming. And I have a feeling I have enough information at the moment. But what is, I don't know whether it's sad or interesting, is that people living with, and I guess I should only speak for my David, does he have a concept that he's gay anymore? I don't think so. Because he doesn't really have a concept of, that's a conceptual, that's an intellectual kind of understanding about sexual orientation, gender identities, that you just don't have that level of understanding anymore. Does it matter to him? No, because he doesn't know what he doesn't know. I think that's what he's got to in the stage where you don't know what you don't know. At the beginning, you do understand what you're losing. And you do know what you don't know. Well, you do know you don't know things, but then you got to this other stage. So whether he's gay or not is not relevant. You know, can he name? I'm embarrassed. You know, like people say to me when we're going to dinner, will David remember me? No, he won't remember. If I say, do you remember Jerry that we went out with last 2 weeks ago? No. No. So, but when he turns up, as I've said, he will kind of acknowledge or have some connection. But memory, you have to forget the concept of memory as we know it.
You have to remember that you're dealing with a person where they're at, not where you're at, where they're at. And trying to deviate from that is not helpful. Going where they're at is helpful.
Absolutely. We always talk about the fact that tone is as important as the words that you say to them.
Absolutely.
And you communicate, you don't correct. I do know there's some people say, well, don't you remember? They kind of get mad.
Yeah.
Well, that's useless. It doesn't help to criticize. I mean, I've watched David be able to do things and slowly lose the ability, one after the other. And he used to make coffee for us in the morning. Well, that concept is gone now. He can bathe himself still, but he needs supervision. Here's the soap. Now put this on your hair. Now rinse. So he can still do it. He can still toilet, thank God, because that's another big stage that will be reached at some point. And that's good. But I know everything will eventually go. So I just kind of, I don't want to keep track of it, but I do notice like he used to be able to put together meals on his own. But now he's my sous chef and I love it. Like dinner time, he wants to help, but it's, and when he puts things away, who knows where they're going to end up in the kitchen.
But you can give him chores which he can actually do.
Yes.
And participate, and he doesn't feel he's judged in the process.
Exactly. And I have to tell myself, Greg, does it really matter where the frying pan gets to? You've got to tell yourself, and does it matter? But sometimes, to be honest, it's faster to do it yourself than it is. But I always have to keep in mind, he wants to be busy. It's good for him to keep busy. So give to him what you can give to him to do.
That's a very key point. Thank you for bringing that up. That's very key. Thank you so much. I'd like to thank Greg for sharing his story about he and David together, and I hope it is an example of how we in the community can find ways of coping. It's very important to develop a network. If you don't have a network, as you deal with this disease, the network becomes so key. Letting your friends in, letting your family in, whichever kind of network you have, is really important. And if you haven't got a network, then come to an organization like Gangray or ARC or something else, and we can help you develop that kind of support.
If you want more information about Gay and Grey Montreal, you can visit our webpage at gayandgreymontreal.com or our Facebook page at facebook.com/GAYGREYMTL or visit our Instagram page at instagram.com/GAYGREYMTL. You can also visit our YouTube channel at youtube.com/@GAYGREYMTL or our threads page at threads.net/@GAYGREYMTL and our LinkedIn page, which you can find at linkedin.com/company/GGMTL. And you can always reach any of these social media by going to our Linktree, which is linktree/GAYGREYMTL. We would like to thank CKUT FM 90.3 on the FM dial for hosting Gay and Grey Montreal.
This is the original DJ Ray. Big up our listeners, you know, listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in stereo.
Spring Into Action, Outrage, is happening March 11th through 24th. Spring Into Action is an annual event series that is organized and funded by QPIRG McGill and SSMU. Every spring, QPIRG organizes a week of free workshops, discussions, film screenings, and social events engaging local and global issues. We have an exciting lineup of events, including a screen printing workshop, community dinner and zine making night, Prison Abolition 101, and other practical and capacity building workshops for organizing in the midst of injustice and anger. Check out the schedule of events at QPIRGMcGill.org or on our Instagram at QPIRGMcGill.
Of mine, if you're young at heart.